Hey everybody, it's Jim and Aaron back with another, or I should say Aaron and Jim. If I'm leading, I should say Aaron, right?
I'm trying to be deferential
to you, Jim. We're back. That's the headline, and we got another fresh bald movie for you. This one is 2006 dystopian science fiction action thriller, is what Wikipedia calls it. Children of Men, directed by one Alfonso Cuarón, who you might recognize as director of E2 Mama Tambien. Or your mom also. Harry Potter and the Prisoners of Azkaban, a.k.a. the best Harry Potter. Children of Men, Gravity, and Roma. It stars Clive Owens, Claire Hope Ashity, Julianne Moore, Michael Caine, Chiwetel Ejiofor, and Pam Ferris, who you might recognize as the hideous great aunt from Prisoner of Azkaban. Jim, I had never seen this movie before. Been on my watch list for a long, long time. I know it comes up a lot of times when people, whenever we're watching stuff, people's like, oh, this reminds me of Children of Men or whatever. I thought this movie was set in the slums of Brazil and it involves some kind of alien occupation.
It's like a District 9 meets
Independence Day
meets Slumdog Millionaire.
it was some kind of like exactly right, like class conscious apartheid allegory, you know, thing. And what I got was a fucking, I don't know, this movie is a trip to watch with the current state of the world. And was really emotionally affecting for me. And it's also just an amazing film. The shots that this movie cost $70 million and every fucking penny is up there on screen twinkling at you. There are like one shot action. Does that get your rocks off? You like that True Detective season one sweeping the slums goodness? Well, there's like four different scenes bigger and more impressive in this film. I think the acting is top notch. The story is great. The characters are great. There's actually some pretty effective humor, which thank God, or I might have blown my fucking brains out before I got a chance to record this review. Jim, what did you think of the movie? This is not your first time, yeah?
No. I saw it once before. It had to be 10 plus years ago. And I remember liking the movie but not being blown away by it, and it's weird because in subsequent years every time I hear somebody mention this they're like, it's one of the greatest films ever made, it's my favorite film, like all of this thing. And I remember not feeling that when I saw the movie the first time. Going back to it, I'm now seeing what everyone's talking about. It's kind of an astonishing piece of filmmaking. And since 2006, since this film has, you know, done what it did with Wonders and just its kinetic sort of feeling, you know, Alfonso Cuarón has done it again. Gravity is much like this movie. But so many other movies have also done it. And like 1917 is probably the most recent one that I can think of that really blew me away, being all a single shot, essentially. So this time around, I was much more impressed by it. I was really noticing the world building that they're doing here, which was just effortless. It felt like this was a real place that I was in. Nothing felt forced. Nothing felt inauthentic. It was all just there on screen in this, you know, like you put a person behind a documentary, just like a handy cam, right? And like sent them out on the street in a world.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly what they're going for, and they delivered it. Like I read a lot of different interviews and like behind the scenes, and that was like the constant. I guess Alfonso had just gotten off of The Prisoner of Azkaban, which is a loaded with CGI film. It's kind of like his first like big effects budget, and there's many times where he was like really wanting to just like call in the CGI army, and his DP and the other producers are like, nah, we really want to do this documentary style. Is always arguing for a practical way to do it rather than CG. And there is CG. I can't even tell the most impressive piece of CG because it's a massive spoiler. Just for people who haven't seen it or people who might have heard about it and think it's set in Brazil, should I give like a little synopsis?
Yeah,
to remind
absolutely
people what this is. So in 2009, I don't know if you guys kept up with the news, but the last human baby was born. because of some unspecified viral or genetic malady that has befallen Earth and its population. The year now is 2027, and most of the globe has descended into chaos and unrest over the fact that humanity seems like we're shuffling into the forever night, the forever sleep, with only the UK, ironically, standing undivided against the chaotic world.
All right, Nazi repression there, yeah.
Yeah. Clive Owen plays Theo, a former political activist that's just now trying to drink himself into an early grave because obviously not a lot of progressive stuff happening in 2027. Faced with waves of refugees and immigration from all over the earth, the UK government responds by caging and placing these fugies in camps. Again, this movie was made in 2006. Suddenly, Theo's ex, who's now leading a paramilitary resistance movement known as the Fishes, contacts him to offer money in exchange for his help in smuggling a young woman to the coast and out of the country. He reluctantly agrees before realizing the woman herself is smuggling some precious cargo, the first full-term fetus the world has seen in almost 18 years. That's the setup of the film. You get there in about the first act, and then the rest of the movie is him, escorting this young woman to a project called the Human Project, which I think you're supposed to understand is like a band of like scientists and other do-gooders that are still doing research and trying to like turn things around for humanity.
Yeah, they haven't lost hope yet.
They haven't given up hope yet. This was based on, I meant to say this in the four part of the episode, but it's based on this this novel called The Children of Men by P.D. James that was written in 1992. I've not read that. I've heard that the plot varies significantly and the setup is quite a bit different too. But if you're looking for more Children of Men stuff, right there. I want to talk about, like, that's the thing I kept on thinking. Like, this movie is made in 2006. I'm not sure when, but sometime between 2008 and 2016, Barack Obama built the cages that then Trump would later famously fill with the children of immigrants and refugees trying to get across our southern border. And I kept on thinking, there's many times I wrote in my notes, like, this is supposed to be a sci-fi dystopia. This is not supposed to be a playbook for how to fucking run society. Mm-hmm. And is it? This film did not make a lot of bank. It cost $70 million to make. I think it made $76 million worldwide. Is it just that not enough people have seen it? Because, like, I can't believe more as much attention as I was paying to politics and, 2015 on, I didn't see the comparisons to, like, Children of Men and this. Maybe I didn't get them because I thought, like, what does the Brazilian slums have to do with putting refugees in cages? But goddamn, I thought that was, like, amazing. Like, what a manifestly bad idea and how dystopian it looks, and yet that's what we ended up doing in real life.
Yeah. I mean, it's probably one of those stopped clock is right twice a day sort of things. Like, enough movie stories get told, one of them's going to hit it. And this happens to be the one. It's kind of amazing that it happens to be such a good one that sort of got it right. But yeah.
Yeah. I've seen that a lot, though. Like, I remember Tom Clancy, I think it was A Debt of Honor, was a novel about these, like, militant Japanese separatists. Because, those are something to worry about in the late 20th century. Crashed a fully fueled jetliner on the steps of the Capitol building during a State of the Union address, killing the president. Like, almost all, like, everyone except for, like, two or three members of the cabinet or two or three designated survivors. And, obviously when 9/11 happened, like, Tom Clancy did all the talk show circuit and the cable news circuit saying, "I told you so" to everybody. Usually when you see stuff like that happens, it's like a bad thing that was predicted and then bad people made happen. Ostensibly, this is something that was a bad predicted just like in, 15 years ago. And then, like, the official state governments around the world enacted these policies. It's really... Usually a film like this, and again, I did not intend this film to be political. I thought this was going to be I knew it'd be some kind of social economic thing, but, like, it's really arresting to see. Normally you get, like, George Bush and everybody gets upset about the war and jingoism, and then the Wachowski sisters make V for Vendetta as a reaction to that.
Right.
This, I'm not sure what it was a reaction to, but it's like a pre-action to what we're seeing today. I can't think of anything else that was kind of just like the feeling of watching this film in 2020.
Yeah, I'm with you. It's you can't help but notice those things while you're watching it.
I found it a struggle to identify with, I guess, the protagonists, the fishes. But I don't know, because like they're the Rebel Alliance in this film, right? But they're also doing some pretty horrific shit for their own propaganda purposes, and they're justifying it because, you know, what else are you supposed to do? You got to give humanity some hope. What I just found is it's interesting to have these people like this caught between two equally bad options,
right? And somewhere along the line, I will admit I don't think I have a full grasp on the fish's motivations and what they're trying to do exactly with this baby, but it seems like they become the bad guys somewhere along the line when Luke takes over, when Julian's killed. You realize that whole thing is you know, some kind of weird false flag operation thing. I don't even know what it is, but along the way they become the bad guys. You definitely start off with them being sort of humanity's last hope, and it changes very quickly.
Yeah, and it's almost like it seems like Julianne Moore wanted to, like, her idea was, look, if you show this baby that's born from a Fuji, it's going to change the world.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to get her to the safety of the ship so she's beyond everyone's reach, and, you know, she can, and I don't know, like, since this is dystopia, it's like I half thought, like, when they pick her up, they're just gonna, you know, because there's all this, like, weird stuff about how they modify cows to be more productive milk bearers or something, and how, like, and there's all this hints that, like, maybe she's going to be involved in some kind of weird fucked up sexual impregnation laboratory experiment.
Yeah.
And I was half expecting, like, when the future came to pick her up, they would, like, hint to some kind of dark portent, but the movie kind of pulls a mild happy ending out of the jaws of despair when they just, you know, play the sound of children laughing and playing over the credits, implying that, you know, the world is able to come back from the brink.
Yeah, I think it's one of the strengths, but maybe also, you know, it's not always easy for this film to convey everything it wants to convey, because it's trying to do it in a very specific type of way. Where it just wants you to kind of be around for the events that are happening in the movie, and it doesn't want to explain any of those things to you. And so I think audiences, myself specifically, can be excluded for the first time around not understanding most of what's going on, particularly in the fishes plot, because it's very complex. And like I said, it's only really presented in that sort of diegetic narrative, right? It's like, I am hearing conversations that I really have to, like, stop and think about the context of and go back to what I know from the beginning of the film or from earlier scenes and try and piece all of it together. And, you know, when you're caught up in a film that's as kinetic as this, that moves as quickly as this film, it can be difficult to do that. And I don't think it's a flaw of the film, but I think it makes it challenging to digest the narrative of this film in one sitting.
Well, and they do a whole bunch of it felt very real. For example, you know, you're following this guy going about his business. The bomb goes off. He, like, freely admits when he's talking to his dad's, like, you know, fuck, it could have been the fishes. It could have been the Fugees. It could have been the government, you know, because it seems like every time a politician gets in trouble, a bomb goes off. They have all those different perspectives. Then you meet Julianne Moore, who I think her character's name is Julianne.
The big fish. Yeah.
Yeah, the big fish, which is, you know, convenient for her. But she tells Clive Owen, he's like, yeah, you're one of your bombs almost. And she's like, we don't bomb. We did that one in Liverpool, and then we learned that we just never do that again. But I was thinking throughout the movie, when Luke kind of, like, you know, has this sudden but inevitable betrayal, it's like, does she even know? And it really got me thinking
about,
like, I didn't
get the impression she did, yeah.
Yeah, so, like, I mean, like, and I'm saying, like, what I'm saying is, like, does she know for a fact that fishes are not involved in making explosives and stuff?
Oh, gotcha.
And I started thinking this in terms of, like, what we're seeing now with, like, the protests and stuff, and how, you know, you got, like, it seems like the middle of the ground take is, well, sure, I like to see justice for George Floyd, and I support the protests, but these damn rioters and looters, they're fucking going too far. And like, I felt like this movie touches on something, a topic of like Julianne Moore, leader of the fishes, saying that they're not doing bombs. Maybe she's lying and she's just trying to do a one person propaganda thing against Clive Owen, but she might be telling the truth, and like people, things beyond her control are happening.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's the whole thing. Like once you get like, once you get a society that's this fucking shitty, where literally like, I don't even know how you, it almost felt mildly unrealistic that you could hold the world together this long for 18 years after, you know, 5 years of no babies. And it just seems like, what the fuck? Like, why are we trying to live now? Are you trying to be the last, the oldest person that needs a nursing home but can't get one because there's no one younger than you and you're just going to die starving and alone? Like, the government is handing out suicide pills but still banning marijuana. I thought that was a nice touch.
Yeah.
It's like once you let society get to a point where people are this hopeless, like, talking about the morality of bombings and kidnappings and property destruction, it seems like it's almost beside the point. Like, you have to always bring the conversation back to what's causing the things, because it's not like people are doing it for jollies.
No, that's what that film's really about, right? Is hope.
Yeah.
It's embedded in the idea of a child. It's embedded in the idea of, you know, a future for humanity. It's something that, you know, permeates the entire movie, right up to the very, very end. And I think like it's interesting to look at the end and sort of say, how do you feel about that? Because to me, it was a very hopeful moment. It's a moment of potentially a new future, one that is, you know, much brighter than the current end of the world that they're experiencing. But I don't know that everyone will feel that way about it.
Well, and that's where, because I thought when Clive Owen and the mother Key, like, there's this harrowing sequence where Clive Owen's fighting through tank battles and crumbling infrastructure and bullets going on both sides. And he gets and he rescues the baby and the mother, and they're coming down, and the military have broken through, and they're in this fish compound, and the first of them sees the baby and he starts screaming down the line, cease fire, because it's just like this miraculous moment of like, everyone gets it, like both the fishes are getting it, the soldiers are getting it, the people in the street, and then that lasts for like 30 seconds until someone accidentally looses around, or maybe on purpose looses around, because they don't want the government to have the baby, they want the baby, and then all hell breaks loose again. Because in that one moment of calm where they're just parting these soldiers and insurgents like Moses and the Red Sea, I'm like, well, there you go, Julianne Moore was right. You don't need a violent, like, just holding up this baby like fucking Simba on Pride Rock is enough to make everyone kind of genuflect and bow and like act right. But that's not the way humans work.
No, I mean, we're seeing that today. It's like, you get moments of realization which quickly fade in the sort of chaotic static of everything else. And I think, you know, it's a shame, and I don't know what we can do about that, but that just seems to be how humans are.
I mean ultimately, my take is we should build a world that's not so fucking pinched and mean, so that people don't have to feel this desperate and are not this close to hair triggers all the time. But, you know, that's my idealistic crusade. I think that I was wondering, because I guess that's why the happy ending didn't sit right. Like, I wish that there was no children laughing, that it's like it's unambiguous, like a hopeful moment, because like you said, you've done the heavy lifting with the baby being born and all the imagery. I thought it was interesting in juxtaposition of like the new pope, the La Pietà statue had been destroyed and all the rioting and stuff. Famously, the Virgin Mary mourning the death of her son Jesus. Man, we gotta need to talk about the Jesus imagery and metaphor in this movie too.
Do we have to? Okay, fine.
But I think that when they pick him up, it's like, you know, you keep playing this. I kept playing this movie in my mind. I'm like, how long would it take for the first terrorist organization to declare itself in hostile opposition to the baby, the Fuji baby?
Yeah.
Because how dare these fucking brown savages, you know, like they're all bought into this, like, God has cursed us to die, and how dare these, like, you know, like it's you know, like if we can't be the future hope of humanity, no one can, kind of thing.
Sure.
Like, that's almost certainly going to happen in this world, right?
Yeah, it's interesting. I was reading Ebert's review, and he points out that it doesn't really seem to be lines are drawn on racial divides in that world. It's more, you know, whether you are a UK citizen or not.
Yeah. And class, because they're still like posh versus.
Oh, sure. I forget.
Yeah. They had like, I forget all the different like class names. They're debating whether someone is this or that, or, you know, like a lot of they'll take this baby and give it to some posh black woman.
It's like, and religious zealots, like renouncers, mm-hmm. repenters, all those things.
Right.
But yeah, the lines of I guess the society left in the UK are drawn on, you know, citizenship status as opposed to racial ones. Maybe, you know, maybe that it would be my hope that wouldn't just return to sort of what we consider normal today.
Do you know what Children of Men was agitating about when they made it in 2006? Because that's what I was trying to put my finger, like, is this a climate change metaphor? Because I know that's one of the things that, like, people that are really thinking about climate in terms of, like, not being an Armageddon, but, like, what's the actual kind of effects it'll be in the next 100 years? And one of the more horrific things is this idea that, like, the first world countries, these developed countries, who are better able to withstand the you know, upcoming climate devastation, are going to close their borders to the rest of the world, take care of their own, and literally just machine gun people at the borders. And I felt like maybe that's a little bit what they were like. They had some kind of trumped up like genetic disease and stuff. But like, you know, this like the scarcity of resources and the fact that like ever few people like fewer and fewer people had less and less. But then again, I don't know. There's also some like there's so much fucking layers to this film, because like when he went to the ministry, it very much felt like business as usual. Like a nice Bentley came to pick him up, and he went to go see his cousin who is living, like literally has this like the most, you know, sculpture of David in his fucking dining room, where he's like, you know, taking lavish care of his children who seem like they're.
Italy's got like four of those. Not impressed.
Especially since Italy just got destroyed. So like, you know, they were going to miss it. But I don't know. There was something about that too.
Yeah, I feel you. It's remarkable. It's a remarkable amount of, I guess it's despair. It's like throwing your hands up. What that guy says about the future. I don't think about it. It's how could you not? How could you not? That would be the literal only thing I could think about.
Because his world is beautiful and shiny and well ordered. You know, it's like it reminds me of like the how many people over the last decade, and I used to be one of the ones. I'm not going to front. I've always been enthralled with politics, but there's I've every time I try to engage a friend in politics, and there's like, I don't fucking care about politics. Who cares? It's like there's echoes of that, and like no matter how bad the world gets, there's always be people like this guy who's just like, well, it's not affecting me. Like, oh yeah, sure. If all you go around and look in the world is doom and gloom, then you're going to find it. But like, look at this. I got a statue of David. See his penis right there and his enormous hands.
Yeah, missing a leg.
I've cybernetically reconstructed his leg. Mm-hmm. see, there's beauty in the world, Theo.
Yeah. If I had to name a single flaw in this movie, it's that they sort of go to the we need the action to move, so let's just have an attack. One too many times.
Really? Because I kind of thought that about the car attack, like, why the fuck is this happening? Are these roaming bands of cannibals in the woods or something? Like, but like, I felt like it got explained. It seemed like every random attack did have a logical thing that was set up in the movie.
No,
what was you talking about?
I think the one that where I noticed it was, like you said, when Clive Owen is walking through the crowd with the baby and Key, and then the shot goes off. Because, like, what happens in that moment if the shot doesn't go off? It's, like, do they just walk to the coast, get in a boat, and go?
And even I thought, as I was watching it, like, when the shot goes off, it's like, so the soldiers, every single one of them forgets about the baby they just saw?
Yeah, what, what happens from there if that doesn't go off. But I guess, like, in the context of, you know, that sort of larger meta narrative and commentary about society and humans, it works in retrospect. But they do it a few times where they have just like moments of calm that are really like the plot is only pushed forward by violence or by the outbreak of an attack.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just maybe noticing it a little bit.
I thought Michael Caine's character, Jasper, Theo's dad, was a fucking treat.
Oh, yeah.
And if you haven't seen this movie, I can describe him as, okay, you know the dude from The Big Lebowski?
Mm-hmm.
That literal character played by Michael Caine.
Yeah. The British dude.
And also, like, not... because the dude is got like a lot of, you know, hippie sensibilities as far as the man and like money and all that kind of stuff. But also he's kind of like hypocritical and lazy about it. And I feel like this, I got that same energy from Michael Caine because he's living in this, you know, pretty nice marijuana illegal growery. But the reason he's so comfortable is because he has a cozy relationship with the jackbooted thugs that run the immigration detention facility, the concentration camp down the road. Supplies them with weed in return for them looking the other way and giving him money. But he's the first to be like, oh, those poor Fugees, those poor devils, or this, that, and the other. But also, you know, it's such a fascinating character. But then he also puts it all on the line to save this baby's life. And I guess... Mm-hmm. I guess if you want a world built to allow you to have crazy, radical, progressive opinions, but the complete moral license to do nothing about it, this is the world. Because why the fuck would you exert any strength into making the world a better place 18 years into a plague where no one's having children and the human race is just going to go extinct?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Like, I try to be the hero of my life story, but, like, I ain't rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic as it's going down, you know? And, like, I felt like I was trying to condemn him for some of this stuff, and then he ends up being heroic in the end. But that's when he switches in. That's when his convictions come in and he swings into action when there actually is something to... some hope to cling to.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the way in which he differs from the dude. It's maybe the only way is that he is... willing to actually sacrifice. You know, the dude doesn't end up doing anything in The Big Lebowski. Like,
he just accidentally goes from one thing to another.
Yeah. It's Walter. It's like there are the forces around him push him down those roads. Where this, you know, he makes a decision and he stands up for what he believes in. You know, like you said, when the hope returns, right? Makes a certain amount of sense.
What a guy, because I've seen him be so fucking menacing, and he's so, like, even when he's kind of, like, in the shittiest part of his dude phase, he's just really effortlessly funny and warm, and there's, like, just
the
really good...
The funniest line from him is when he's talking about I don't know if it's a political branch, I don't know if it's, like, a religious sect or whatever, and Clive Owen goes off on him, right? Like, talking about how shitty they are and everything, he's just like... I was trying to tell a joke.
Yeah.
It's just about, really
about
good.
The Englishman eating storks for. And Yeah, he's really good. Honestly, like, I've liked Clive Owen for a long time, but he's really amazing in this film. And it's hard to, like, point to any one thing he does. He's just just very, very convincing at being this everyman who used to be very, very idealistic. Then the fucking baby virus came and he's just, like, given up. Like, he just wants to get enough money to... Why does he need money? I missed the point of why he so desperately needs 5,000 pounds. Because, like, it seems like his plan is to just get enough money to drink himself into stupor to get through the next day, that he can get enough money to drink himself into a stupor.
I think that's just it. I think, you know, he doesn't have any plans for the 5,000 other than drink some more.
But she said, like, I know you needed money. And I was trying to think of, like, was there some kind of, like, therapy that his mom could afford if they had some more money? And but I don't know.
I don't think so, no.
Because I thought his motivation, that's the other thing. And of course, it's one of these things, like, I need to watch this film again. But I never want to. I don't really want to watch this film again. Maybe if there's a really, you know, in a year or two and things are, like, better, they're not gonna be perfect because we're a long fucking way from that. Yeah. But like, in the sun shining just right, I might watch this movie again because I do think it bears repeated viewings. You'd get a lot more out of it. And there's a lot you talk about the world building. Like, there's a lot of stuff I was curious about. Like, why does this boss have all those ass paddles hanging in his office?
Come on. God, they're not ass paddles.
What are they?
They're cricket bats. They're not ass. Although I will say, I did think we were walking into a principal's office.
There was,
when I thought
there was all sizes and stuff. And I'm like, what is this collection of medieval ass paddles? It's this really guy? Kinky. It's a cricket bat? It's a cricket bat.
They're
of course
bats.
It's a cricket bat.
Of course they're cricket
okay.
bats. Yeah.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense now. I was thinking, it's like, what is this? What is this guy? Like, they're trying to sell that he's a hard ass or that he hated children.
Or he's the,
yeah. He's graduating his ass. He worked up from the smallest replica cricket bat to the biggest one. And now he's got an iron ass, a stiff upper lip and even stiffer bottom cheeks.
I assume he's some kind of like, maybe one of those is like his little league equivalent cricket bat. You know, he's been keeping all these from his whole life.
Or, you know, you go to bat night at the Cincy Reds and they give you those like commemorative, like little, you know, I love those things as a kid. Those like little foot long, like miniature Louisville Slugger bats. You could like whack fucking golf balls and stuff around with ping pong balls.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's one of like the UK's probably got miniature bat night, cricket bat night. First 5,000 show up, get a commemorative miniature cricket bat. All right. Not ass paddles.
No.
Never mind. That was not an attempt at world building.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers get to exercise their voting fingers again this week with another prestige movie poll. This week's nominees are Mystic River, The Last Samurai, and Secondhand Lions. Take your pick and seal our fate.
This Monday on the Premium feed, we open up the books and deliver a State of the Empire podcast, talking about the current condition of Bald Move and our plans for this year.
This Friday, it's Lunch 420, which given last weekend seems like a tragic missed opportunity. Ah well, lunch will be served piping hot at 1 p.m. Eastern. Come join live or warm up some leftovers when lunch is released in podcast form later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
But there's a lot of stuff like they talk about cutting off. I looked that up because I thought that was bizarre and I'd never heard of it before. As far as I can tell, that's not a thing. Cows don't have like eight, are not bristling with udders, and they just like fucking lop the ones that are not useful off.
Why is that in there then? Is that,
I don't know. Something I don't.
Is that like part of the dystopia?
That's what I'm saying. Like, I thought this was foreshadowing for like whatever horrible fate that was going to, meet her at the end of the film. But it never came up. There's a lot of stuff like, bulletin board saying like, not taking a fertility test is punishable by blah, blah, blah. It's a crime. And, harboring immigrants is a capital crime. Like all this other kind of like dystopian shit that's going on in the background. I had a whole ass paddle and cow nipple theory, and it's been exploded.
Speaking of things that I thought were going to go somewhere, I thought were going to mean something. Mm-hmm. He hurts his feet several times in this movie. They show one shot where he steps out into mud in his socks or something. Then they show a shot. This is very Die Hard. They show him injure his foot and he screams fuck or whatever. Somebody hands him a pair of shoes later on. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what they were even trying to do with that. If that's just like, oh, we need this to feel authentic, and somebody running through all this rubble would probably hurt their feet.
I think it's back to the thing you don't want to talk about, which is the Jesus allegory. You know, like there's lots of foot washing in the Bible associated with Jesus amongst his disciples and apostles. It's a religious, I think that's something they do in Islam before they go to their prayers. They ritually wash their hands and feet and their heads. And then when the only pair of shoes he could find were like sandals, I thought that was another, you know, piece of Christ imagery. The guy's name's Theo. Yeah. You know, you've got a lot of, and didn't Key joke that she was a virgin? Like they actually had an explicit, like, you know, and there's something to like Joseph and Mary trying to escape with the Savior, you know, through, I guess it wasn't war torn Rome, but it was you know, Roman Judea. They fled to Egypt to get away from it. There's a whole ton, like the fact that the separatists are called the fishes, is all like this Christian allegory kind of wrapped up to it. And it didn't feel super forced because, they didn't draw a lot of attention to it. And also, like, I fully, you know, like if there's going to be some kind of like violent uprising in America or UK, there absolutely will be some kind of like, you know, super Christian version of a separatist organization. There's just like that religion's too bound up in the society for it not to be.
Yeah, I wish I had looked up the foot stuff going on in this movie, because it's all over the place. Like, it's everywhere in this movie.
There's also a lot
of nasty close-up of Clive Owen's feet at one point.
He does have some fucked up, muddy feet in this film. There's also a lot of stuff with animals. Like, in almost every shot, there is an animal that is being affectionate towards Clive Owen, or he's scratching their heads or something. It's like, I think that might have been something they were early on kind of like, you know, putting a halo around him. Like, look, all the animals love him. No one's afraid of him. He's got this suave. That's how Julianne Moore's character described him, the Key, that he's very suave.
Yeah, they're painting a picture of a broken man, obviously, in Clive Owen's Theo. Somewhere along the way, again, this is not like super specifically laid out, but they show a lot of pictures of a child with him and Julian together. And you come to realize, oh, that's his son who was probably killed. I think they say maybe died of cancer. They don't really dwell on it. They just kind of like bounce back and forth, like bounce over to it for a second and then go back to the main narrative
puzzle
of the movie.
Piece for his character that snaps into place, like, oh, he's got experience being a parent, which pays off in the late in the third act,
and it explains so much about why he's broken. It's not only the fact that, you know, the humanity is on its way out, and the no births are happening, but also that he lost his child, who would be still pretty young, I think.
He also, like, there's an oral fixation with his character, like three separate occasions he deflects there's that, I didn't even think of that, but there's he deflects negative attention from himself onto someone else's, like, your breath stinks, you've got something stuck in your teeth. And then he does that party trick where he blows a ping pong back and forth into Julianne Moore's mouth and catches it. I noticed it, but like, it's kind of like the feet thing. I'm not entirely sure exactly is it. I kind of thought, like, maybe if I go real deep into Jesus well, that there's like some kind of wafer metaphor with the ping pong, but like, surely not. But it was one of the funny, that's what I'm saying, like him and like Michael Caine's like interaction with people, I think is one of the funnier, is very fun. The fact that like this one jackass gets done in by Clive Owen's door twice in a row, I found very funny. Like, once when he's... Yeah, that one dude, Patrick, I think is his name. He was the one on the bike that was trying to kill Julianne Moore and them, and he opened his car door and flipped them out, killed his cousin. And then as Clive Owen and company are rolling down the hill trying to push start this car, he comes running up to try to get him again, and he opens his car door and sends him flipping over the car again. Yeah, I thought, there's a couple other, like, just really funny kind of, like, jokey joke moments, which I really appreciated, because this movie is otherwise really, really bleak. Nothing ever, like, every single time you think something good happens, it's actually something bad. What is that? The Peter Mullen shows in, and I thought Sid was going to be kind of a good guy, but it turns out not really.
What is it?
He's an opportunist.
Picking movies that dude's in. Like, we just did Trainspotting not too long ago. Yeah. Obviously, we just came off Westworld.
Yeah.
Which actually is my introduction to that guy, apparently.
Same. It's the first time I actually... Top of the Lake was my first introduction to the guy. He's fantastic in the first season. Yeah, yeah. But Westworld is what made me learn his name. And like, yep. Oh yeah, this is a guy. This is a guy that to pay attention to. He's getting a lot of cool work later in life. But I enjoyed him. I mean, thought he was pretty funny too.
Everything he's in, I'm blown away by him. Like, he's a different character. He's just as convincing in that character. It's all like, even when he's talking about himself in third person, I feel like that's somehow a real dude. Even though. Mm-hmm. Meeting someone like that in the real world would be fucking strange.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, he pulls it off.
Yeah, and you do have it like the way they characterize George Remus on Boardwalk Empire. Like, every once in a while, you get one of those guys who can just fully pull off the third person act.
Uh-huh.
You know, like Prince. I don't think Andre the Giant did, but Andre the Giant could, you know, like he could Andre the Giant could unironically pull off a Hulk smash, Hulk do this, Hulk do that if he wanted to. Peter Mullen pulling off, I don't know what you call him, concentration camp guard.
Yeah.
With a heart of gold, not because he's nice, but just because he's always looking for the angle to make money and a name for himself.
Uh-huh.
I also really appreciated there's at several points where Clive Owen has to, like, you know, put himself at the mercy of, like, pretending to be a refugee or rely on the kindness and support of the Fuji network. And I loved how they use, like, language barriers.
Yeah.
In very tense situations, like him having to take the time in the middle of a street shootout to, like, draw a picture of a boat because she can't understand the word, you know, rowboat and et cetera.
Or when
I thought
he
that added
it.
A lot of drama.
Like when they're in the bus and she's going into labor, her water breaks and he's piss. He's Caca. Pretending to have a language barrier.
Yeah. To get to play on the guard's natural disgust for the Fugees and the way their squalor that they're forced to live in. But yeah, I don't know. It's a wild because, like, you know, again, the movie ends in it ends on a note of hope, but also it ends on an airstrike against a giant refugee facility that's going or camp that's going to destroy a whole bunch of refugees.
What's a worse name, Froley or Bazooka?
I think Bazooka's kind of badass. So Froley. Okay. Froley sounds like a made up word in an Alice in Wonderland poem.
Yeah.
Like, it's a potion you drink before you drink your Froley juice before you go off to face the Bandersnatch, my son, with their vorpal blade that goes snicker snack.
It definitely
sounds
like
the Jabberwock and the Juju fly. Yeah, like
Terry Pratchett kind of.
It's very, very Froley. Very fucking Monty Python. It's a woody sounding phrase.
I do like what they do with that. It's like, A, it's fun. Froley, Bazooka, both terrible names for a baby. But then she eventually settles on the name Dylan, which is Clive Owen's son, was Clive Owen's son's name. And I feel like that is so directly connected with the idea of hope and how, you know, Clive Owen's hope, Theo's hope throughout the film returns. You know, he's sort of confronted with the idea that humanity might not be doomed. And that changes his outlook on life. And by the end, he's got this sort of monument to him in the form of this first child that's been born in 18 years. And I think it's really...
It's progeny, yeah.
Yeah, it's a really nice way to end this film, which is why I felt the hope at the end of this film that a lot of people, I guess, maybe didn't.
No, I loved it. The fact that, like, he makes use of his experience as a father, because this woman is pretty young. Like, I don't... She's probably older than 18, but maybe not.
Well, I was wondering if the woman they were talking about being the youngest woman might be her after the youngest man gets stabbed to death. They say the new youngest person is a woman.
Surely it wouldn't be a refugee, though, right? Would they track that amongst the...
Probably not, yeah. But maybe she's even younger and they just don't count her.
But either way, I like the idea that, like, you know, no one else, like, she's never seen a baby or like certainly in her living memory, not been able to see how to, and him like teaching like basics of like how you care for a child, how, you know, how you can comfort them, all that kind of stuff right before he dies. I was screaming, tie your fucking boat to the buoy. What the hell are you doing? Yeah. You're going to die and this thing's going to drift out to sea and this baby's going to starve because it's foggy out. Like, fucking tie it to the buoy. What the fuck is your problem, Clive Owen? Do you not have rope in the boat? Before you die, it's comforting the child's fun and nice, but you got to tie that thing off to the buoy. What the hell?
I kept looking and noticing they're not getting any farther away from this buoy, which is a little strange.
Yeah, I thought so too.
I was like, oh, they must have anchored this thing for the purposes of filming because... Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. If you'd thrown out an anchor, I guess I would have bought that, too. But shit, I don't know. I wonder how far out in the ocean are they? Are they in a channel or something?
I don't know.
The English Channel?
Sure.
Perhaps. I don't have a hell of a lot else to say about this film because the commentary, a lot of it is just self-evident. It's super beautiful. The action scenes are amazing for what they are and genuinely tense because, you know, I think, you know, we've remarked this a lot. You can add as many CGIs and as have a whole bunch of CGI Harry Cavill flying out of a whole bunch of CGI. I don't know, Fuckface McGee, and if you don't give a shit about the characters or think that they're going to die and there's no stakes to those deaths, it doesn't matter. These are, you know, very impressive visually, but like from a stunt, you know, like from a stunt thing, it's just average people trying to kill each other and not be killed. So it's not amazing, but it just feels fucking real. And
that's the
thing. I was on the edge of my seat for that final battle because I was just like, this movie was fucking brutal. The way it introduces characters and efficiently gets you to care. Like, I knew Julianne Moore for less than 15 minutes and felt gutted when she died. Mm-hmm. Her given death face, like when she was like kind of like slack jawed and her eyes were pointing in two different directions. Like, I don't know if they did a CGI or what, but that was just did a really good job of introducing characters, making me care about them, killing them to the point to where, like, I honestly didn't know how brutal this film was going to be.
Yeah.
Like, I could totally see, like, it being a folly of man kind of exercise to have this mother and child killed in the middle of this melee.
Sure.
You know, squander your most precious resource because people can't stop shooting each other long enough to listen or do something different. But because of that, because these characters are so well defined and the cause is so the stakes were so high, they're very fragile, normal people. Like, I was just on the edge of my seat through a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, I think to me the most impressive, maybe in its ingenuity or its like kind of flipping an action scene on its head, was that car chase scene and the way it starts, the downhill. There's something just so slow and boring about a downhill race in cars or a downhill chase in cars where the cars aren't on.
You take that back because the Commando downhill dead car chase is one for the ages.
It's been a while since I've seen that one. This is maybe, okay, this is the most recent best one I've seen.
Yes.
But the cars aren't on. They're traveling at no more than 10 miles. Not running
speed. A guy can sprint up. A guy can catch up sprinting, dude. Yeah.
And it's so fucking tense because of it. And they get to the bottom and then, you know, the chase begins. It's like...
And there's even a moment of humor where, like, you know, Clive Owen's trying to jump start this thing or push bump start it. And he like goes 3 feet. And she instantly tries and he like comes like, no, damn it. You got like it's like that kind of like funny frustration. Like, I've seen my mom and dad do that when my dad was trying to get a car started at my granddad's one day. And it's like, you know, we didn't have a bunch of screaming people chasing us. But like there's like little moments of humor in everyday kind of like, they're not action movie stars. They don't know what the fuck they're doing. They're not Arnold Schwarzenegger.
No, and it feels super real in those moments. I mean, obviously, the most technically impressive one is the battle scene at the end. But the one also that felt strange and weird and interesting to me was that car chase.
There's also no annoying characters. Like, I feel like almost every movie has the, like, I thought that midwife was going to be, like, you know, she made a mistake at that bump starting thing, but it's something that anyone could make. You know, like, at no point there was a person that, like, gave them away by crying irrationally or acting in a bizarre way.
Baby, like that fucking baby.
The baby you can get away with. But something I want to talk about. CGI baby. That's a pretty good CGI baby for 2006.
It was a CGI baby.
It had to be a CGI baby.
Hmm.
Well, that's how fucking good it was, Jim.
I know. Yeah, I'm impressed.
You don't even know it's a CGI baby. Now I'm worried. Is it a CGI baby? Children of Men.
It was
yes.
two babies.
There's a 3-minute cut on YouTube called Children of Men CGI Baby.
Nice.
And there's an FX reel, I guess, from the VFX house that did it. So, because how the fuck do you have a fucking baby in some of those scenes and stuff that they were doing?
Yeah. Can't set off a squib next to a baby's head.
You cannot. There's probably laws, actual laws against it. Let alone the filming restrictions. You know, you're gonna have that baby on a cold, muddy set for 16 hours. Hell no.
No.
Trying to get a oneer.
It can only work for 4 hours a day. Sorry.
Trying to get a oneer with a five hour old baby. No, you're not gonna be able to do that. It takes 6 weeks to get that one shot.
Yep.
What do you think? So, what's your stance on the oneers that are actually not oneers but are just cleverly put together as CGI?
You know, everything is cleverly put together with CGI nowadays. Who gives a shit?
Okay.
If it serves the story, if it serves the aesthetic, go for it.
I do think it's kind of like a steroid era in baseball. There should be like a dividing line of like, okay, this is when CGI was invented and all oneers are suspect.
Yeah,
there is a little bit of like practically doing all the things, like the one from Goodfellas where he's walking through the restaurant and all that, like, you know, just everyone hitting their marks, having all this chaos and like in order in the middle of it. Like there was something to that. And I'm not taking away the accomplishments, because even like the one, you know, I sucked off at the beginning, the True Detective one, that was using a lot of like door frames and things to cleverly hide like cuts in the action and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think you're right. I think it's still impressive, and I think it's a super immersive technique too. Like just like 1917 had my pulse pounding, this naturally gets you engaged and going, because there's not a chance to look down at your phone or be distracted or disengage. It's like if you bought into the characters and you bought into the action, you bought into the stakes, it's like you can't fucking tear your eyes off of it.
Yeah, I mean, and I'm going to be progressively less impressed with seeing those things, but now they're, you know, but that's true of any CG. I think like the early CG you saw with like Jurassic Park, you know, how they seamlessly blend the CG and the animatronics and stuff.
Yeah,
all of that was super technically impressive. It could blow you away with its visuals. Nowadays, it's just that's status quo. That's just like
what you expect.
Yeah, if you don't have that level of immersion, you're failing on a filmmaking level. But I think like, you know, oneers are kind of getting to that point where it's like, okay, you did a whole movie as a oneer. That's technically impressive. Now it's a tool in your toolbox. It's not something to be, I guess, celebrated on its own.
Yeah.
All right, there's one other thing that I wanted to mention, and it's how much I like stories that don't really give you the cause of the event that changed the world, like these dystopian ones specifically, because we're never told what causes the infertility that leads to, you know, 18 years of no babies. And stories like The Leftovers, zombie things, actually, 99% of the time, zombie films don't explain the cause of the zombie outbreak. It just happens. Mm-hmm. And then you take that and you start from there and you build out. And I think Children of Men is fantastic at building out from its core premise, which it doesn't explain, just infertility has led to this.
Yeah. No, I agree. And it also frames, it also quickly sets it away from like a mystery, you know, where it's like, oh, the scientists have to find the resolution. There's a secret we have to uncover. And it like puts your mind at ease to like, nah, that's not what this movie is about. Uh-huh. It's like, this is, and allows you to like, and, you know, every minute you spend with some fucking doctor in front of a CGI screen explaining how things happen is another minute that you can't have Julianne Moore blowing a ping pong ball into Clive Owen's mouth and really thinking, oh, they're a cute couple. It's a damn shame that they got, but now they're back together and off. Fuck, she just took a bullet through the throat. You know,
yeah.
I agree, less explanation of backstory, because it just gets you in trouble too.
I think that's one of Cuarón's kind of philosophies when it comes to narrative and storytelling. He likes you to just sort of experience it and be in the narrative of the cinema, not the narrative for the narrative's sake.
You know, one thing that Cecily and I have been doing as an escape for the world is we've been watching Bob Ross. Although they've started running political fucking commercials under my free Bob Ross channel, and it's no longer the refuge that I thought it was. The other thing, we've been watching all the Harry Potter films with the riff tracks enabled.
Uh-huh.
And you pointed out something right before we started recording that like Alfonso Cuarón seems to write most of his material. The one exception, as far as I can tell, for his whole fucking career is Harry Potter. and A Prisoner of Azkaban. And Seth and I kind of resolved to like get the Blu-ray so we could start watching the special features and stuff. And I would love to hear his, because like that's the total opposite. You're coming, he'd never worked on a big budget, never worked in effects films. I guess Guillermo del Toro is the one that talked him into it, because he's like, I don't know, Guillermo, they got coming into these this kid book series. And Guillermo's like, have you read them? He's like, no. He's like, Jesus Christ, you've got to make this movie. But like, what was it like to have the complete opposite? Like, not only do you have like all of this stuff set before you, but you have to have a particular beginning and an end point that you have to hit. I know that's like a lot of the Marvel people have expressed frustration, the auteur Marvel directors, that like, goddamn, you just like, this shit's on rails. You don't have a lot of room to put your own stamp on it. I wonder what it was like for him to work under, you know, that giant budget, that giant microscope, and just very little creative freedom when it came to the structure of the story itself.
Probably somewhat frustrating, but it seems to me like that might have been his sort of career loss leader. You know, the status boosting event that he wanted to get so that he could make things like
Job and
Gravity and this and you know, Roma, things like that.
Yeah. It's funny though, because like this is one of the few directors that I feel like I've seen almost everything that he's made, certainly after E2 Mama Tambien. Mm-hmm. I saw that because I was a huge Roger Ebert fan. And I think moved out on my own, and he like fucking raved about it. And I liked being pretentious and like watching a foreign film. So I think I've seen every single one of this guy's films except for Children of Men, which I didn't even know he directed it until we kind of selected it. But I've seen every one of his films pretty much as they came out. It's been kind of fun. And it was really fun watching this, like just seeing, I watched Prisoner of Azkaban like just a couple nights ago, and like the lighting and sudden cinematography is unmistakable.
Yeah,
like the exact same techniques used, the exact same lighting and color schemes and palettes.
Yeah,
I said,
Gravity,
film,
you know, feels as intense as this movie feels in its most intense moments.
Yeah, and like, you know, I think that's also interesting. He's a great choice to turn the Harry Potter franchise from its very kiddie, like, you know, the first two books are essentially The Hobbit, and then it turns into Lord of the Rings, where you're fighting a dark lord and the world's going to shit and it's just children being tortured. And like Alfonso Cuarón really turned that corner and gave the movie a decidedly darker tone that then later directors came and essentially copied. So good. I don't know who the fuck made that call. Hey, let's get the guy who did E2 Mama Tambien. Let's get him in here. See what he can do. Sure. We had Chris Columbus, Home Alone, you know, works great with children. Let's get this guy who does this like super sexy, erotic coming of age Spanish film. Let's get him in here.
It does seem like a strange choice when you put it that way.
To direct these 13-year-olds. They're going to be dicking down Professor McGonagall this year. It's, you know, it's going to be some inappropriate older lady relationships. You need to see E.T. Mama Tambien, sounds like, Jim.
Wait, I thought that was Harry Potter.
Oh,
no.
No, I was blending the two. I was remaking.
I've not seen it.
If Cuarón was able to write his own Harry Potter,
gotcha,
that's the direction he would have taken it. All right, that'll wrap up our coverage of Children of Men. Next week, we're falling in a Hoff hole.
Yeah.
We enjoyed our little taste of Philip Seymour Hoffman we got in last week's coverage of The Talented Mr. Ripley. And Jim decided we want to go back to see, I think this is a 2005 film, Capote, about the novelist and personality Truman Capote. I've never seen this. Have you?
I haven't either. I was considering maybe doing The Master, but I have seen that. So I wanted to see this.
And I've seen enough of it, like, you know, commercials and stuff, to know it's a very different, like, he's got this like very soft spoken, you know, kind of silky performance that I've not really seen him do before. So like, I'm pretty excited about it. But yeah, we'll be back with Capote coming out in our Prestige threads. And of course, next week's big, our return to The Walking Dead over there in the pulp threads. Or the pulp feed, the Bald Move pulp feed. If you want to check that out, it's also in the old Walking Dead feed, if you still got that active. But yeah, that's that handles both your vitamins, pulp and prestige. We'll see you next week. Thanks for listening. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Later.